A libertarian's libertarian who has one of the most fascinating minds in the nation. On Uncommon Knowledge today, Richard Epstein. Uncommon Knowledge now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. A professor at the New York University School of Law and a fellow at the Hoover Institution, Richard Epstein is one of the nation's leading constitutional scholars and one of its leading libertarian thinkers. Professor Epstein is the author of many books, including recently The Classical Liberal Constitution, The Uncertain Quest for Limited Government. Richard, welcome back.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
I want to turn to the Supreme Court in a moment, but first, the meta issue of the day, inequality. Wage stagnation for the middle class for some decades, but an increase in household income for the wealthiest 1% of American households over the last 35 years, I looked this up, of 275%. And I found this quotation from my friend Richard Epstein. Quote, inequality can be a wonderful force for innovation, close quote.
Yes.
Explain yourself.
Well, I have to explain two things. First, the disparities, and then the second point. There are two ways in which you could solve the inequality question. One of them is you could take from the rich and hope to give to the poor. The first half of the program always works. The second half always goes astray. The other thing that you could do is you could try to eliminate the various barriers which prevent middle class and lower income people from moving up. And those are not macro policies having to do with financial situations in the Federal Reserve. It essentially means unlocking the employment relationship by getting rid of all the things that the proponents of equality have put into place.
Such as?
Minimum wage laws make it harder for unskilled workers to get their first job, which makes it impossible for them to get their second job. Anti-discrimination laws makes it harder to hire minority people because it's more difficult for somebody to fire them. Strong unionization gives various kinds of wage increases to a select group of individuals, but it shuts out large numbers of other workers. What you have to do in these things is to completely deregulate the labor markets. What will happen is, in a competitive market, as productivity increases, wages will start to increase, and that will be sustainable because the persons paying the money are getting something that's worth it. Are there going to be excessive returns to capital? The answer is no, because of the competitive process. What's happened here is all of the last 6 years, we've been running the progressive program. And that program has essentially resulted in real terms of a decline in income at the median level of about 4 or 5%, depending on how you count these sorts of things. It is a direct consequence of the way in which we have been doing this. Now, that's the practical answer. Now, the theoretical question is really very different. It's, do we mind about inequality as an abstract matter?
Right.
And the answer is, suppose the two of us start at 10, and I find a way to go to 20, and you only go to 11. We've increased the inequality, and we've increased the wealth of both people. Technically, amongst the economists, that's a social improvement. But according to the egalitarians, then there's really a terrible situation because the gap has gone from 0 to 9. You don't want to get yourself into that frame of mind. Now, why is it that it turns out that the gaps in a market system run that way? This has to do with the problem of incentives. What happens is if somebody comes along and creates something that gives enormous value to everybody else, they may move up one or two units, and that one person may move up $1 billion.
Right.
But do you think we're going to be better off in a world without a Steve Jobs or an early Bill Gates on the grounds that their great money is going to go to waste now that they have it, whereas everybody else is going to be denied the funny apparatuses that they've been able to produce?
Okay, so let me make sure I understand the Richard Epstein position. Two points, both of which are pretty arresting in, let's put it this way, they'd be arresting if you saw them in the New York Times.
Yes,
position
astonishing.
Position number one is, you don't care about inequality per se. You don't care how big this gap is, as long as the person down here is moving up.
Right.
The gap, you really don't care about the pattern of distribution, as long as those least privileged are making progress.
And they will only make progress in an open market.
And then the second, which brings us to the second point, which is also very arresting. Wage stagnation is not a result of the new normal. It's also not, I'm surprised that you didn't mention globalization.
I will.
All right. But fundamentally, wage stagnation is a result of intentional government policies which have made matters worse, not better.
Yes, they're trying to protect workers and you limit their options. It doesn't help.
All right.
What globalization does, and it's very important, is it means that unionization can no longer work for the benefit of unions or their members. If you're going to be getting goods from all sorts of places, there are no firms around today, unlike, say, 50 or 60 years ago, that are going to be protected from competition by government regulation or oligopolistic formation. If you unionize a competitive firm and you try to get a monopoly rent, you drive the firm out of business. So what's happened is...
Witness General Motors.
As General? Example. Well, 500,000 workers in 1979 and 41,000 workers when it went into bankruptcy some 35 years later. So you don't want to get yourself ever into that frame of mind. And what happens is the administration has doubled down on this. All of the initiatives that have taken place either through the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board or through the board itself are trying to make things easier to do. Unionization. Now, elections, those are things which have actually been quite well run by the board. They want to shorten it. That will mean that the workplace is going to be under perpetual turmoil as firms will always be worried about unionization. But more importantly, you saw that the McDonald's chief officer was let go the other day. But they have another problem from the board. The general counsel has decided that McDonald's is the employer of every worker of every franchisee that it has, all 15, 17,000 of these franchises.
Who has decided that?
The general counsel of the labor board. So he's going to sue them. So now instead of having each worker having only one boss, they've got two. And you're putting McDonald's in a position where the entire franchise model that it and every other franchise arrangement has used for the past 50 or 60 years is now in jeopardy because of the labor board.
Those franchise operations are where a lot of people get their first job.
And they're also a place where a lot of middle class people get their first proprietary type interest.
Right.
And so what you're doing is you hurt everybody. The basic flaw in most systems about regulation is you assume that if you restrict the opportunities of management, you've helped labor. But these are contractual arrangements, and any time you hurt one side of the contract, it radiates through and it hurts the other side as well. Okay. So the shrinking pie is always a losing proposition.
Last question on inequality. And on this one, I've got you.
Sure.
You ready?
No.
So, fine, the pattern of inequality doesn't matter as long as the people on the bottom are making... I'll give you that. But here's where it does matter. If you get people who are fantastically rich at the top, they end up getting, it distorts the entire political system. As witness, just recently, the Koch brothers announced that they and organizations they have founded and their rich buddies intend to spend, rich individuals,
$700 million plus,
almost $900 million in the 2016 election cycle, which is more than the Democratic Party or the Republican Party spent in the last presidential election cycle. That's an outrage on the face of it.
No, let me give you a slightly different interpretation of what's going on about all of this. One of the things that we note is that you can measure the success in terms of political abilities by figuring out which way the transfer payments start to run. If the Kochs were as good as you started to think, then you'd expect that the top 1% would be really in clover when it comes to taxation and so forth. But essentially what happens is if it has, let's say, 20% of the income, which is a lot,
right,
it's got 40% of the tax burdens. To understand the public choice theory, if you're sitting there as Mr. Moneybags, you have ability to fight, but you're also a perfect target. And even though you have a lot of dollars, the other guys may have a lot of votes. And so what it does is it becomes some kind of a standoff. What you really want to do is to create a political system in which there's so little intrigue going on by way of government initiatives that the Kochs will find it perfectly silly to spend money on politics because there's nothing that they want to be able to get. But given the current structure of political rights in the United States today, everything is contestable, everything's up to game. And at that point, the Kochs are going to come in, and the unions are going to come in, and the activist groups are going to come in, and basically most of this stuff is going to be destructive. You talked about my book, The Classical Liberal
Yes.
Constitution. The central theme of that book is you want government structures and individual rights to be sufficiently stable that whenever the government has to regulate a tax, it's going to do so in a way which will raise everybody simultaneously. Current politics is I win, you lose.
Right.
And what the Supreme Court does is sits benevolently beside and it applauds a trend that it is unwilling to stop.
Which brings us to the Supreme Court. I'd like to ask you about two big cases that the court has announced that it will decide in the current term.
Mm-hmm.
Obamacare. By the way, I'm going to try to set this up you know me well enough to know there's every chance I'll make a mistake even in setting it up before I get to the question. So correct me if I err. About some portion of the states have already set up their own exchanges under the Affordable Care Act, but some, a large number, over a dozen, have refused to do so. To serve the people in those states which are refusing to set up exchanges, the Obama administration set up exchanges, an exchange at the federal level, and yet the law states that subsidies will be made available only by way of exchanges, quote, this is important, this is the language of the law established by states, close quote. So we have a U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit ruled last July, it was a split panel, which raises the question that this federal exchange may be unconstitutional, and the court will now decide. I will ask you how it will decide, but first, how should it
decide? First of all, it's not that the federal exchange is unconstitutional.
Okay, correct me.
What is that the subsidies are not permissible to people who get their insurance coverage through the federal exchanges, which is a very different proposition.
So the federal exchange may continue to exist, but you won't get the subsidy.
And subsidies could be 20, 30, 40% of income for people who are at modest levels. Right. So it's
essentially a big deal.
And it leads to immense complications. Now, the way in which it should be decided, this has got the following kind of moral dilemma. The people like Harry Edwards, who voted in the dissent in the D.C. case. As he said, look, it's just absurd to say that one funding mechanism should give you different treatment from another funding mechanism. These are close substitutes. You have to do it for both. The problem with his position is twofold. One is established by the states means established by the states. It doesn't mean established by the federal government. More than that, what the defenders of this have said textually is they're sort of picking up because the states, you know, want them to. States don't want them to do it. The states have refused to do it. So they're doing it on their own initiative. It's not even a cooperative effort, which I think a couple of exchanges should, and those things should be protected. The second thing is we now have an explanation, pretty clear, as to why it was that they drafted it this way, so as to avoid the problem of clerical or Scrivener's error. What they wanted to do is to basically give the states an incredibly strong incentive to set these things up. And Jonathan Gruber, that misguided MIT economist, sort of boasted about all of this.
Who was the central architect of Obamacare.
And now they're trying to disown him. So once you find out that the text and the motivations work in the same direction, what's going to happen is the Supreme Court, this is now a prediction, 5-4, it will decide to strike this thing down. Justice Roberts is not dealing with a constitutional issue.
As he was in the first Obamacare case.
That's right. So at this particular point, I think he'll flip over. The four liberals will follow Judge Edwards' kind of view on this. It will come out 5-4. It's a source to me of genuine anxiety. I don't like Obamacare. I'd like to see the whole thing radically be done, say, along the plans of Healthy Indiana, if you're going to play the subsidy game in any way, shape, or form. What's going to happen is once this thing gets struck down, which I think is likely, the renegotiation that's going to take place in Congress is going to be a horror story. The Democrats will basically just sit firm. They'll say, we want you to make the two exchanges in parity. And the Republicans will start to demand concessions on either the 40-hour wage limits, the definition of an essential benefit, or something of that particular sort. And it could take a long time to sort this out, which means that a lot of people in the public are going to be caught in crossfire, and nobody will know whom to blame.
Stop. So the practical consequences that you just outlined, it'll be a horror show, should or should not weigh in the deliberations in the conference of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Fiat justitia ruat caelum was a maxim which says, may justice reign even though the heavens fall. And half the people who say it believe it, and half the people who say it don't, right? And so what's going to happen is it's going to be a lot of question about temperament. And I would say about Tom Griffiths, who's a friend of mine, is that he is one of the least intrigue-like judges you'll ever meet. He's just a textualist. And Roberts is the same way. So their attitude
Tom Griffiths, why are you mentioning Tom Griffiths?
Because Tom Griffiths wrote the majority opinion in the D.C. Circuit on the panel.
Right. And okay? Roberts is Chief Justice, Supreme Court Chief Justice.
But it was also on that court. They are not conservative activists. They're not libertarians at heart the way I am. On administrative and statutory stuff, they try to call them as they see them. And they really do that. Griffiths is an absolute straight shooter when it comes to all of these things. And I think the fact that he wrote the opinion will carry weight with the five, that this was a straight bona fide effort of statutory construction.
Jeffrey Toobin in The New Yorker notes that the five judges, not justices, but judges in the circuit court who voted to uphold the law were originally nominated by Democrats, and the two who voted to strike it down by Republican presidents, quote Jeffrey Toobin, "The case is not an attempt to police unclear drafting, but rather the latest effort to destroy a law that is despised by many conservatives," close quote. You refute him how?
Look, I mean, it's just a flat-out piece of defamation against Griffiths. This guy has no ideological agenda whatsoever. In fact, time after time, I have berated him in person for being such a straight stickler by the rules. I mean, and, you know, he has struck down many programs that libertarians like. Let me just give you one illustration. Sure. There's a case called Abigail Alliance, and the question is whether or not people
with
in Syria... This is about 6-7 years ago.
All right.
And the question is whether or not people who have an end-stage cancer are entitled to get drugs of a cancer treatment, Erbitux was the drug, without the approval of the FDA. And the case law from the Supreme Court went very much in the opposite direction, saying they have plenary power to regulate these things. Doug Ginsburg, a former student and a good friend of mine, he's more of a libertarian. He and I think it was Judy Rogers say, you can't allow this kind of interference between people and their only source of salvation. Tom looks at this thing and he says, this is what the precedents are. This is the way I'll do it. If the Supreme Court wants to change it, it can change it. And of course, they denied cert. This is not a man who does these kinds of things. I mean, and Jeffrey has become, I'm sorry, very reckless. He used to be a serious constitutional analyst. Listen hard, Jeffrey. You're not taking your job seriously anymore.
Richard, all right. The Supreme Court and gay marriage. Again, listen closely as I set it up to correct the almost inevitable error. We have four circuit court decisions that have overturned state bans on gay marriage on the basis of the 2013 case, Supreme Court decision, U.S. versus Windsor, in which the Supreme Court invalidated President Clinton's Defense of Marriage Act. Then this past November, we have a different circuit court which upholds state bans on gay marriage, creating a split that only the Supreme Court can resolve, and the court has said that it will do so in the current session. All that correct?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. So first, let's go step by step here. Treat me as an especially slow student.
With pleasure.
First, U.S. versus, yeah, exactly. It comes only too easily. First, U.S. versus Windsor. The Defense of Marriage Act permitted states to refuse to recognize gay marriages that took place under the laws of other states, right?
Yeah.
Okay. The measure passes both houses of Congress by veto-proof majorities,
right,
and is signed into law by President Clinton in 1996. On what ground did the Supreme Court invalidate the Defense of Marriage Act?
Well, actually, it was not the Equal Protection Clause. It was a rather complicated theory which saying that marriage is an area which is exclusively reserved to the states, and the Supreme Court is, or rather the Congress is treading into an area where it ought not to go. I regard this as absolutely a fantastically incompetent decision in terms of its legal stuff.
Written by?
I can't even remember which justice who wrote it, but whoever wrote it.
I suppress
it, but the whole thing has this sort of contrivance. The supremacy clause that federal laws take advantage over state laws. You're not here talking about how states organize their own marriages. What you're doing is you're giving individual states the power to do what they seem to see fit. The federal government, when it comes to defining marriage for federal tax purposes and a bunch of other things, takes full control over it. They really wanted to gun this statute down.
It was 5-4?
I think so.
So who's the putative conservative who voted with the liberals on this?
I think it was Robertson. No, Kennedy would probably be the one on that case because, right, remember, he was the one who wrote Lawrence against Texas.
Tell us about that one.
That was the case
criminal statute, yes?
Yes, on equal protection grounds, but not because it applied only to same-sex couples, but because the whole thing was essentially in violation of individual rights to privacy. And what happened is, in that opinion, Kennedy wrote and said, I'm only striking down a criminal law. I'm not requiring the states to recognize marriage. It's 12 years later. The political winds have surely moved in that direction. Jeff Sutton, who wrote the Sixth Circuit opinion.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. So we have, that's why the court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. Four circuit courts use that argumentation to strike down state bans on gay marriage. And these people are all Judge Sutton to the likes of me, but he's your buddy, Jeff.
Yeah, he's a buddy.
On what ground does he say, no, I'm upholding state bans?
He does it on the same ground that you did, Peter. What I mean by that is, you said, I don't understand how something could be unconstitutional if it has been everywhere in practice, everywhere in time. And in 1996 or 7, the Congress upholds it unanimously, right, through the Domer Act in both places. When does it become unconstitutional under a provision written in 1868, and why?
That's your question. Damn good question.
And what happens is Sutton says there's no damn good answer. Okay. He basically says, look, it's one thing for you to sort of strike down novel, crazy sorts of things, but when something has been tested by time, everybody starts to approve of it. To come in and to say that which is durable is also irrational is to him an inappropriate way of doing jurisprudence. Now, look, Jeff, myself, Chuck Cooper, by the way, who argued some of these cases.
Chuck Cooper is a litigator.
Litigator
Cooper
in Washington.
What's the firm, major figure? All right.
Cooper and Kirk, and he's another good friend of mine. You know, he does two things. He argues the California case to defend Prop 8, and then he organizes a lesbian wedding for his daughter-in-law and her partner, right? I mean, some of us have figured this out. What you think about these things and what you think the Constitution requires don't have to necessarily overlap. And, you know, that turns out to be my general view. Now, as politically, if I'm a Republican strategist...
Go ahead. I want to get back to the court, but go ahead.
I want this thing to be struck down so it's no longer...
Because it splits the Republican Party, the Libertarian versus the conservative wing. Right. Okay. But take me into the conference chamber, conference room of the Supreme Court. How should they reason? I want your prediction in a moment, but first, how should they reason this through?
I think what they should do is be more or less originalist with respect to it. Recognize that what the practices were, recognize that the issues never came up at any point inside the debates, recognize that every single precedent until the last 10 or so years treated not necessarily as a libertarian would want it, all the questions relating to marriage and the incidence of marriage is something within the morals head of the police power, which was reviewed essentially under a highly deferential standard. And therefore, they should follow the Sutton opinion. That's what I think they should do, but I don't believe they will do it.
As a matter of law, Judge Sutton's opinion is correct.
I think so.
Okay. What will they do?
They will basically, what they will start talking about is the sacred nature of the relationships, the irrational nature of the discrimination, the implicit hostility towards gay people that are existing in these traditional laws, say that we cannot as a nation tolerate that. They may well refer to the capital punishment cases where they say evolving senses of decency means that just as capital punishment is
no living constitution.
Yes, and it will live and flourish under this situation.
And which of the concerns? It'll be 5-4?
Well, Kennedy will clearly go over if it's going to be.
Because he wrote the Lawrence decision. You can just see this. Okay. So now let me ask you this. As a libertarian, your personal view or your, I don't know quite what, how you would phrase it, but your view is gay marriage should be legal.
I'm also in favor of legalizing polygamy, which none of the gay marriage advocates are.
That's another show, Richard.
Oh, that's okay, so, but an important one.
So, of the 36 states, I did some homework for you, of the 36 states that now permit gay marriage, in only 3 has gay marriage been acted as a result of a ballot measure, and in only 9 has it been enacted by the legislature. In the remaining 25, one half of the states in this union, gay marriage exists because of a judicial decision. And in those 25, 16, including big states, California, Florida, Virginia, 16 states in which the people explicitly voted to ban gay marriages, and the judges, the courts, overturned the explicit will of the people. Millions of Americans, literally millions of Americans, have voted against gay marriage to see their will set aside by a few dozen, literally, men and women wearing black robes. Can it not be argued, indeed, how could one resist the argument that this represents as blatant a judicial overreach as has ever taken place in American history?
Well, I mean,
it is a judicial coup.
Well, let's put it this way. It is certainly judicial initiatives. Brown v. Board of Education was, of course, in many cases subject to the same sorts of arguments. And I just want to caution you.
I'm just wondering why you're so cheerful as you discuss this wrong decision that you see coming. Where's the aim? As Bob Dole, why would I want to associate myself with this? Where's the outrage, Richard?
I don't like to be outraged because it just makes your life shorter and less happy. but I will like to try to be a little bit detached and analytical about this and explain what I think has happened. The Supreme Court is coming in very late in the day because it senses that if, in fact, these these issues were put to legislative decisions now or in 5 years from now, all of those outcomes that you report would be reversed.
But why can't it?
Sorry. And the correct answer.
You should let them do it then.
And the answer is, let's just wait. Now, the question is then, how do you distinguish this from Brown v. Board of Education, right? And, well, I think you can do that. Brown v. Board of Education involved a systematic campaign of oppression, which took place in large measures because in the years between 1868 and, say, about 1915, the United States Supreme Court systematically gutted all the protections that were given by the 14th Amendment to deal with racial equality.
So the court created a circumstance.
And then I think it ought to have undone it and so forth. Now, the parallels between the two of them in many cases are, of course, that with gay rights, it's a libertarian movement saying to recognize it, just as trying to get rid of segregation was to some extent a libertarian movement. The difference between them is the gay rights movement today is a political juggernaut. In fact, if you try to oppose it, you're going to get squashed very effectively because these people are extremely committed, extremely articulate, extremely
well-organized. Well, not everywhere. There are states that will
want... I understand. Okay. I understand that. But with Brown v. Board of Education, the groups that were being protected did not have anything like the clout. Right. So in 1938, in a case called Caroline Products, Justice Harlan Fiske said, where you're dealing with discrete and insular minorities, it's in those cases that judicial sanctions or judicial interventions are most powerful. What gets you upset, and rightly so, I think, in this case, is you're not dealing with a discrete and insular minority. It's no longer 1962 where gay sex acts are in fact criminalized. This is a situation where these guys are riding the crest of history. Better to legitimate it by doing it in 5 years than to do it in this fashion. I don't think you would have said that about segregation in the South in 1954.
I hope I would not.
Well, I remember, I was alive then, at 11 years of age, you know. My Mr. Greenberg in my sixth grade PS 161 class, he said, you know, this is even more important than Roger Bannister breaking the 4 minute mile, which had happened about 10 days before.
PS
161.
In Brooklyn?
Brooklyn, of course. Can't you tell by the accent?
Yes. Okay, Richard, Obamacare, gay marriage, the Supreme Court. Let me ask you questions about how a libertarian thinks about other issues, maybe in some sense even larger issues or overarching issues. Lawlessness. Two quotations. The first from President Obama this past summer. Quote, middle-class families can't wait for Republicans in Congress to do stuff. Meaning, I, the president, am going to take action on my own. So sue me. The quotation ends, so sue me, close quote. Senator Ted Cruz, again this past summer. Quote, of all the troubling aspects of the Obama presidency, none is more dangerous. Dangerous. Than the president's persistent pattern of lawlessness, his willingness to disregard the written law and instead enforce his own policies via executive fiat. And that came, attached to that came a list of 76 instances in which Ted Cruz or his staff identified the moments when the president of the United States had set aside existing law to substitute his own actions.
Only 76?
It may have been 79. But it was under. I did read the list, and they all looked pretty plausible to me. I think they had them. I think it was a correct list, in my judgment. Barack Obama says he's just doing his job, and Ted Cruz says he is engaging in dangerous lawlessness. Where's Richard Epstein?
I'm much closer to Ted Cruz on this one than the president. First of all, the president says we can't wait for the Republicans to do stuff, right? The word stuff, it lacks a certain degree of precision. If he means stuff, the stuff that he wants to do, he's only making things worse. And this then, I think, tells us something about the relationship between the distribution of powers on the one hand and substantive outcomes on the other. One of the reasons why we care so much about separation of powers and checks and balances is unilateral actions by single individuals often lead to very serious mistakes. And so if you make sure that the procedures are going to be followed, you may slow things down a little bit, but you're likely to get better outcomes. The president has supreme self-confidence in a set of sort of political propositions, which I regard as economically naive and socially dangerous. And so when he basically wants to go unilateral, we use two ways. We get bad substance and we get bad procedures. It also invites retaliation and imitation by a Republican when he gets into power, where these guys will start to do it. One of the long-term advantages of a system of separation of powers, which also applies, say, to the Senate and Harry Reid and the filibuster, is if you keep all of these things in place in any one term, the other guys will reciprocate. It means that changes in control will be less dramatic in terms of their changes in social outcomes, and you'll get a greater measure of social stability, which is really important. Because what the president does by executive order, a Republican president in 2017 can undo by executive order. And in the meantime, people are trying to figure out how they rely on what's going on today in order to plan their actions tomorrow. And if they know that they could be reversed yet a second time, everybody loses in the uncertainty. And so I think the president has no idea of how reckless his behavior is. And the irony is he keeps complaining about the miserable outcomes, all of which are attributable to his policy. Let me give you one other example. The president was in favor of keeping unemployment insurance at 99 weeks or close to that. Yes. And he thought there was no moral hazard. Dream on. Whenever there's a subsidy program, there is always moral hazard. The only question is how much.
You better explain the term moral hazard.
Moral hazard means that if you protect people against certain kinds of risk from dangerous conduct, the consequences of it, they're more likely to engage in the dangerous
thing. You get more of that conduct.
Yeah. So what happens is if you want to protect people from the risks of being unemployed, you'll get more unemployment. And everybody understands it. The question is just how powerful an effect it is. And at 2 days, it's not very formal. 26 weeks, which was the old equilibrium, probably the relief in giving people a chance to get a job, it may be worth it. But once the Democrats found that their bluff was called by the Republicans and they shortened the period, all of a sudden, the recent studies suggest that unemployment rates fell down and employment surged. The moral hazard explanation applies. Moral hazard is not part of his intellectual universe. And if you don't understand that—
And yet he was a colleague of yours at the University of Chicago Law School.
Now, please, he was a senior lecturer, not a professor. And he was, shall we say, an evanescent figure. He taught at the law school, but he never fully engaged in the internal culture, and he certainly never engaged with the law and economics type. And the way you can tell that is words like—
How many times did you have lunch with him?
None, while he was in office, but I'm not alone.
And look at the shape the Republic is in.
Well, but I mean, I know him outside of that because his best friend is Marty Nesbitt, and for many years we were neighbors on Woodlawn Avenue, and I would see him through that thing, and I played ball with him and so forth. He's a great guy in those days in terms of his personal ethic for work and excellence and so forth, but he's never let himself get systematically educated. And what's so extraordinary about him is how little he knows and how confident he is.
You're talking about a man who started his undergraduate education at Occidental, as I recall, which is a fine, certainly very expensive, fine school in the West Coast.
And
then he went to Columbia.
As did I.
As did you. And then he went to Harvard Law School. And you just said, I think this is a direct quotation, he never permitted himself to get educated.
That's right.
What do you mean?
Well, you could go to these places and get the greatest education in the world if you want to, but you have to expose yourself to some systematic discipline. And that means, in effect, it's nice to know a little bit about price theory, nice to know a little bit about ethics, you know, rigorously taught. It's nice to know something about evolution and doing this, nice to know something about game theory. He never, as an undergraduate, was serious about his work, and the evidence for that is he's never released his transcripts, right? And we know why. And at law school, he was, you know, energetic in a political sense in an environment, Harvard 1988 to 1991, where the critical legal studies, the critical race studies were really very important. He imbibed much of that stuff. He comes to Chicago. He works terrifically hard on his biography and so forth, and then on
Audacity.
He writes a book. But it's not the kind of book that you'd write. It's not a poem.
It's not your book on the uncertain quest for a
limited government. I mean, it's just such a complete difference in what it is. And he spent a lot of time being a nighttime politician, which is his choice, spent a lot of time in the assembly, a part of time being in an activist law firm. And what he never developed as president of the United States is a consistent worldview that is capable of sustaining the heavy burdens of domestic and foreign affairs. And so everything is sort of ad hoc.
Last question on this lawlessness. The solution, the Republicans in the House of Representatives have filed suit. Why? Why the long face?
Because it turns out that there's such a very heavy established document that the Supreme Court and the lower courts will not get involved in political struggles between the two branches of government.
So you are telling me that the President of the United States has engaged in repeated lawlessness,
yes,
which you have just argued has done serious and very likely lasting damage to the constitutional order itself, and there's no recourse.
No, I didn't say that.
Okay.
I mean, apart from the elective resource of voting people out, one of the things is all of these programs have to be enforced. And what you need to do is to think very hard about the technical body of law known as standing. And standing says who's entitled to protest against government action. And the way in which it's been traditionally and erroneously interpreted, you have to be basically in the guy who's being run over by the truck. Which means that if a bunch of citizens are upset about structural changes, they can't protest them. Constitution does not require that outcome. The tradition of equitable lawsuits, as they're called, was designed to prevent corporations from misbehaving by allowing a single shareholder to protest. The same thing should happen with respect to these things. So what you need to do is to change the standing rule so that anytime the president wants to enforce any one of these programs, somebody brings an action to enjoin him, saying that it's beyond the powers of the president to do. That will solve it.
And the standing rules are part of the federal code?
No, they're part of the, it's a misreading of the United States Constitution.
So we have to wait for the judges who are going to give us gay marriage the day after tomorrow. We'll get around to this 20 years from now.
No, the problem with the judges is every time they get around to it, they make it worse. But you have to understand it's the conservative judges who are taking the lead on this, not the liberal judges. It's Justice Scalia is the most eloquent spokesman for the wrong position on standing about direct injury being required. The provision of the Constitution, I will just say it to you, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity. That seems to be a very broad grant of judicial power, right? And then the next clause is only if you have standing. The word standing does not appear in the Constitution, and the theory of standing is utterly inconsistent with the grant of jurisdictions over cases in equity, which include injunctions against ultra-virus activities by municipal corporations, private corporations, and by states. It applies to the federal government as well.
Oh, Richard. Okay, so let me name two unlikely events. The first is that I get elected president. But the second is that if I do, I promise to appoint you to the Supreme Court right away.
Thank you.
A couple of final questions, Richard. President Obama has expanded the administrative state. He's established a pattern of executive disregard for the law. He's weakened the United States abroad. We've established, or you've argued all this right here. How permanent is the damage? If the right person is elected in 2016, does the country, well, do things get better quickly?
They get better. Let me put it this way. Market institutions tend to right themselves more quickly than foreign affairs. So if you stabilize the tax system, repeal most of the executive orders, what will happen is people believing that they have four, probably 8 years of stability, they'll start to return in droves to the market. Mm-hmm. Foreign affairs are much more difficult to repair. The change in administrations are likely to be disastrous, and people who have been betrayed have been killed. And so it's going to take a huge commitment of positive resources into these places to restore, whereas domestically, all you have to do is to deregulate, which is cheap.
Stop doing stupid stuff.
Yeah, it's cheap.
Okay. Two figures from history. I'm going to give you an outlandish comparison. Ronald Reagan in 1980. Mm-hmm. The economy is in terrible shape. The Soviet Union is rampant. Mm-hmm. We're suffering, as the campaign takes place, we're suffering a this running humiliation of hostages in Tehran. And Reagan insists, not on grim optimism, but just sunny, cheerful, the country's best days lie ahead. Now let me go back. You're a man who knows large swaths of the Justinian's Code in Latin. Let me go back to the ancient world. We have St. Augustine from North Africa, watching the sack of Rome, the first sack of Rome in 410, quote, I'm not going to quote it in Latin, tidings of dreadful events have reached our ears, often have we wept, close quote. Are you closer to Reagan, I remain sunnily optimistic, or are you closer to Augustine who realized something large and magnificent was ending?
Well, remember, it was pretty late in the day for Rome, and they sacked the place, right?
They did.
They weren't sacking the United States. They were just having interest rates of, 16% prime rate in 1980. My view about it is that I think, in effect, that if you could get the right people, I'm an optimist about this, because I think the decentralized power of markets in a stable government framework can do wonders in a very short time. One of the consistent mistakes that people make is they assume that markets take a long time to adjust to change in circumstances.
And it happens fast.
Very fast. And it happens very fast, very good. My favorite story about this is one from George Stigler and Milton Friedman when they wrote the one article together.
You know, two great economists, University of Chicago.
Yeah, well, you know, this, how long did it take after the San Francisco earthquake for the rental rates to return to normal? And it was about 6 or 8 months because people started building furiously because there are no entry levels restrictions, right? And so everybody knows what the target is and you come back to equilibrium. Then you start to figure out how long is it going to take New York rental markets to equilibrate under rent control. It started in 1921 and we're still in a state of rapid disequilibrium. The rule is until you get high vacancy rates, we can't deregulate. The moment you keep the regulation in places, you will never have high vacancy rates. And so the city continues to sputter along with a whole series of subsidy programs, all of which are expensive and wasteful. That is essentially the choice that you're facing.
Final question. Although his support among young people has eroded, as his support among people of all ages has eroded, President Obama still retains his highest approval ratings among the youngest cohort that pollsters question. Briefly, alas, because it's television, what do you say to an attentive 18 to 25-year-old to persuade him to leave behind the cool, progressive politics of Barack Obama to embrace libertarianism instead?
Let me give you a famous quote. Do you think you're better off than you were 4 years ago? You know who said that as well as I do. It's the same man, Reagan.
Ronald Wilson Reagan.
Yes, well, in fact, they're not better off. Then the question is why? Now, you have to get the message across that opportunity matters more than subsidy, that it's sustainable and so forth. But you can't do it if you're a Mitt Romney type, sitting there, age 65, somewhat stiff, obviously comfortable in country clubs. What the Republicans have to do is they have to roll up their sleeves and have somebody who's younger and somebody who doesn't have elitism and privilege coming out of every pore. I think that, you know, there's a huge difference between people like myself who come out of Brooklyn and have, so I would say, a little bit short on some social graces, and people who come out of Manhattan who are not. But I think Brooklyn, in many ways, is the better metaphor for this, because I think what you have to do is to get immediacy. The one reason I say this with some degree of confidence is I've spent my last 47 years as a law professor. I used to think these kids were old when I was 25 and they were 25, but now that they're 25 and I'm 71, they're not so old, and yet you still have to learn to talk with them. And this is what I try to do.
So do you have a candidate already?
No, I don't. I mean, my first requirement is they be somebody under 55.
That rules out Jeb Bush?
Yes, I think they have to be somebody who is not acerbic and nasty in the cut. I think that gets rid of Ted Cruz.
Does it get rid of Chris Christie?
I think so, because he's a bully. And that's it. So I
Rand Paul?
Well, he's a work in progress. And if he keeps in his current position, he will not be able to win the presidency. He has to develop a degree of flexibility and a kind of degree of openness that I don't think he quite yet has. It keeps Scott Walker very much in the mix. And then God knows there may be some Republican we've never heard of who can come forward. I mean, I think the great tragedy the last time around is that a man of genuine substance, although not, quote, great stature, Mitch Daniels, right, was knocked out because of all these marital complications very early on in the cycle. And I think he might have given Obama for a run because he has something that Obama lacks. This man is a genuinely good governor, genuinely good university president, genuinely able executive and administrator. What you have to do is to basically project an image of passion and commitment to the people you're talking to, coupled with a sense of executive competence so they know that you won't muff it when you actually get into power.
Richard Epstein, thank you.
You're more than welcome, my friend.
For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.